This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. It's estimated that 70% of Americans will rely on Social Security for the majority of their retirement income. If this is true, how many will spend their final years in poverty? In this portion of the program, we're going to talk about how well or ill prepared we are for retirement. We'll also look at how we arrived at this juncture. Our guest is economist Teresa Ghilarducci, an advocate of retirement reform. She's the author most recently of When I'm 64, The Plot Against Pensions and the Plan to Save Them. Ghilarducci opens an early chapter of the book with these three sentences. Their food for thought. Retirement income is falling, it is less secure, and it is distributed more unevenly across income, class, and gender lines. Listeners, I invite your phone calls for our guest this afternoon. We look forward to your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Teresa Ghilarducci holds the Irene and Bernard L. Schwartz Chair of Economic Policy Analysis at the New School for Social Research. Prior to taking that position, she taught economics for 25 years at the University of Notre Dame. Her books include Labor's Capital, The Economics and Politics of Private Pensions. Her new book, When I'm 64, The Plot Against Pensions and the Plan to Save Them, published by Princeton University Press. And again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Ghilarducci, thank you so much for joining us this
afternoon. I'm so happy to be here.
Social Security will be the largest source of income in retirement for 70% of Americans. But as you note, late in the book, it replaces just 40% of pre-retirement income for the average wage earner when retired. So how soon will the majority be relying on Social Security for retirement income, and what are going to be the consequences?
Well, it's probably right now as we're speaking. If we did a snapshot, I think the crossover point has already been reached that most retirees rely on Social Security for most of their income. That's a true statement. The middle class retiree probably gets about 50-60% of their income from Social Security, and then middle class and down retiree will get almost 100% of their income from Social Security, or maybe if they recycle aluminum cans, that would be another source of income. But most of their income will be from Social Security. What that means for poverty is one of the reasons why I wrote the book. That became a motivation because the first time since the 1950s, we will see the rate of poverty among the elderly go up, and it'll be especially true among what we call vulnerable populations, divorced women, lifelong low and medium wage workers. And more I'm hearing from people, and more the data is showing that another group of vulnerable people are people that we never thought were vulnerable before. These are middle-class workers who are headed for a middle-class retirement, but they have a lot of debt. And that we have never seen that before, where older people are actually debtors and not savers or creditors.
Yeah. Also, a number of us are having our pension plans, things that we thought were rock solid, disappear. In the introduction, you tell us about a retired airline pilot who lost more than 68% of his pension.
And that is a little unusual. Pilots have to retire at 60, but they can't collect their full pensions until they're 65, and then their pensions are greatly reduced if they're guaranteed. But actually, the good news is at least that pilot got something. There are a lot of people who have 401k plans or other kinds of individual account plans that have disappeared completely. Enron workers are headline employees, but a lot of people come into retirement with greatly reduced pensions. And that's a big reason why Social Security is becoming important, and that's a reason why the poverty rates will go up in probably about 5-6 years.
Yeah. Also, some workers have seen pension freezes.
Yeah. Workers who are in industries that are that are retrenching, for good reasons, these companies are having to cut back on benefits. It's not a good thing, but it's a good reason. But there are some companies that are very profitable that are getting away with freezing traditional pensions and replacing them with these individual accounts.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that. Let's get down to some basics. You write about a shift that we're seeing from defined benefit plans to defined contribution plans.
Yeah.
What do these terms refer to,
yeah,
and what are the advantages and disadvantages of each for workers?
Yeah. Well, if you have a random selection of Americans, listening to this program, then about 20% of the people listening are going to have what's called defined benefit plans. And those pension plans are a promise to pay by your employer a set amount of income for the rest of your life when you meet certain age eligibility requirements. It could be age 65, it could be even earlier. But the company has made a deal with its employees or a public sector employer, a school or a state or a city or locality, to pay you a pension based on your earnings and your years of service. And that pension is valuable because it is an annuity. It's paid until the rest of your life. A more dominant kind of pension, and most of us don't call those pensions. We just call them individual accounts, are a defined contribution account where it's defined how much money you put in as a worker. The employer may or may not put in money, but often they do. In a recession, they can end their match or their contribution. And all you're assured of is that money going in. You're not assured of the money lasting long enough to serve you for the end of your life. And it doesn't insure the amount. It doesn't insure the rate of return. None of that's defined. Only the amount of money going in is defined.
Okay. So 401k plans
are defined.
Profit-sharing plans.
Yes, are all defined contribution. But I think defined contribution is a word that is a misnomer and is misleading because it's only defined because it's not defined contribution because it's not defined benefit. We are now seeing, especially in this recession, a lot of companies not contributing. Even though it's defined contribution, their contribution is zero. And that defined contribution, of course, doesn't continue to be added to if you lose your job or you go someplace else. So it sounds more secure than it is.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what has motivated companies to move in this direction? Is it a profit motive? Is it globalization? What's going on?
It's such a great question. I wish most people would ask it. One of the reasons I wrote the book is because I wanted to look at what the motivation, what was behind the change. When I testified in front of Congress or talked to people, the assumption was that it was the environment, the globalization, the kind of natural changes that happened in an economy that moved us away from the behemoth manufacturing firms towards a more secure economy in which everybody was changing jobs and not staying with their employer longer, kind of an evolutionary thing, and that the defined benefit plans went the way of the dinosaurs. The environment became hostile to them, and they just evolved away into something else. The other story is that that defined benefit plans were attacked, and their decline was somebody else's win. And I found that the latter is true, that companies made money when they ended their defined benefit plan and they started a 401k or profit sharing plan, mainly 401k plans. And they actually saved money because not everybody contributes in the 401k, whereas in defined benefit plan, the employer has to include everybody. And the employer doesn't have to put in any money into a 401k plan. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. And so the fact that they could actually not have to contribute or vary their contribution also let them save money. I might add that half of workers don't have either a defined contribution or a defined benefit plan. So we are looking at now the fourth decade of an expansion of Social Security where not more than half of the people have any supplement to Social Security.
Mm.
So even this big revolution in 401k plans hasn't moved coverage one iota.
How many employers with defined contribution plans, I know we don't like that term, or 401k, let's use that term, require employees to contribute?
Hardly any employers require their employees to contribute, and about 20% of employers don't contribute anything to their plan. Now, a big move in Congress is to pass legislation that makes it easier for companies to get 100% of their workers into the 401k plan. But right now, most employers let people just opt in, you know, when they want to, and that turns out that about 80% of their employees will contribute at any one point in time. So at any one point in time, you have an employer that says they offer a pension plan and they call it a 401k, but at any one point in time, one out of five of the employees aren't even contributing.
Hmm.
They get credit for offering the 401k plan, but they don't have to cover everybody.
Oh. It's a little frightening to think about. When I think about retirement, of course, I'm thinking about myself. But when I look out over the society, this means drastic changes, does it not?
Yeah, it's something, you know, we have not really tolerated as a society people becoming so much worse off just because they're old. And so one thing that's frightening is if people don't have income when they retire, the taxpayers may have to shell out a lot more, you know, welfare payments to older people. You know, that's one, like, this very practical on the ground source of fear. The other frightening aspect is just how immoral it is to have a society that doesn't take care of its old. And I was shocked at my ability, about the facts letting me back up my sentence, that we are facing a decline in retirement standards. Because when I was in school and everything that we learned about at social policy, the one shining light was always that we were able to drastically cut the poverty rate among the elderly. Beginning in the 1950s, one out of three of the elderly were in poverty, and Social Security was this huge success program. You know, at least we were humane enough to get the elderly out of poverty, and I see a reversal of that success, and that's what motivates the book.
Hmm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, economist Teresa Ghilarducci. She is the author most recently of When I'm 64, The Plot Against Pensions and the Plan to Save Them. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon, excuse me, with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That line is 800-222-9455-800-222-WILL. Let's take a call now. A listener on line one in Danville. Good afternoon.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I tell my two boys to remember the time when George Bush was elected on his second election, and he tried to reform Social Security. And he was just eaten alive with his idea of people having individual retirement accounts. And also I'd like the guest to talk about President Reagan did that with a group of workers down in Texas, and they invested their money, and they ended up to be millionaires. And thank you for your time.
Right. The caller is referring to two events. One is the experiment in Galveston, Texas, where some public employees were subjected to an experiment where their defined benefit plan was transferred into an individual account plan or a 401k plan. So your caller is right. And the rate of return paid on those pensions were quite high, and some of the people did do better. But overall, than they would have under the old plan. But overall, a government report published around 2005, which is the second thing that the caller was talking about, was a period in which George Bush wanted to privatize or create personal accounts for Social Security. Anyway, that report, 2005, on the Galveston plan showed that overall almost everybody in that plan would have been better off if they had stayed in their defined benefit plan. But it's the poster child. It was the one experiment that President Bush pointed to that suggested that doing it for the whole Social Security system, taking it from a defined benefit plan to a defined contribution plan, would make everybody better off. The reason why George Bush's plan to privatize Social Security was shot down was because most people would not be able to earn the kind of rate of return that he was proposing that people could earn if they put their contributions into their personal account. Most people wouldn't. In fact, 90% of the people would probably do worse than the president proposed. The other reason why it was shot down is because it made the fiscal situation of Social Security worse because the contributions were diverted into these personal accounts. And at the end of 2005, or you know, about late summer, the only people that really wanted that plan were the Wall Street firms that would have gotten all this money into their firms, and they would make money managing that fund. I mean, almost nobody supported the president's plan in the expert community, and then a lot of worker organizations and retiree organizations also saw that most people would be worse off.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Let's take another call now. A listener in Urbana, line two. Good afternoon.
Yes, if your guest is aware, she probably is, of the situation in Illinois for teachers at the state university's retirement system who have their, even if they've earned their 40 quarters in Social Security, their Social Security benefits are reduced based on their state university retirement and other retirements. And I wondered if you could address that.
Yeah. I'm sorry about that. It's a quirk in the law that goes something like this. If you are in a state, there's about a handful of states, I think it's less than 10, whose workers were in a retirement system before the Social Security system was established. And many of those states have subsequently joined the Social Security system, so there's no such reduction. But the handful of states and group of workers that aren't in the Social Security system are subject to this rule that says if you're not a lifelong worker in Social Security, even though you meet that minimum, then we're going to reduce your Social Security benefit by your teacher's pension. Now, the argument for that from the Social Security system's point of view, even though a teacher, you know, someone who gets a reduction in benefits might not appreciate it, this is their best argument. The best argument is that Social Security is designed to give a high rate of return to very low-income workers. And so if you are a worker who shows up in the system as having a very low levels of contributions, the system assumes that you've been a lifelong kind of minimum wage worker and then gives you a huge rate of return in order to, you know, prop up your income. Now, you also can show up in the system as someone with low contributions if you've only worked in the system for a short period of time and you went on to work in a non-covered Social Security system. So the Congress tried to correct that mistake by saying, look, we don't want middle-class teachers to get the advantage in Social Security that we meant for low-income workers. I know it does seem unfair, and it's a problem that rests in Illinois not joining the Social Security system. It would be solved if everybody who's left would just join the system. And I'm an advocate of that. But it would take some transition, and it might take a little a little bit of effort because each case is different. But it's true for Texas, for Illinois, for California, the big ones.
Because a listener
wanted. It seems like it's quite an inequity for. Teachers, for my colleagues in other states.
Yeah. You know, the only thing that I can say to reassure you is that if you hadn't been a teacher, if something happened and you couldn't have taught in Illinois, you could have gone back to the Social Security system. So you should think of your Social Security service as kind of an insurance that you didn't need, you know, that you actually, you know, went on to, you know, to have a good job. But I can see your point.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This listener raises a question in my mind. People who are in the public sector, teachers, firefighters, municipal workers of all stripes, a lot of these pensions are in trouble. They're underfunded.
Yeah.
And we think of public sector workers as being somewhat insulated, but, you know, with rising deficits, one wonders.
Yeah, I want to say that the public employee plans is the area that I least worry about. Not to say I don't worry about it, but those plans are by and large much better funded, and will be ongoing for those workers. For the most part, maybe taxpayers will have to put in more money. But the workers themselves have a secure retirement. There are a couple of exceptions where I do worry, and that is in Illinois, where the plans are woefully underfunded, especially the teachers' plans in Illinois. So you're sitting there right there, I know, in the middle of the state, and I would be worried too, but mostly as a taxpayer rather than as a teacher. What I do worry about, though, is the retiree health benefits that states have promised their workers or school districts have. Those aren't funded like the pension plans are, and that's going to be an issue.
Yeah. Out across the landscape, what does the sorry state of our retirement situation mean for the health and well-being of retirees?
I'm so glad you asked that, too. I have a chapter where I actually talked about exactly the living standards of elderly workers. And I found some surprising and kind of moving items. The first fact I wanted to check was the conventional wisdom that people fall apart after they retire, you know, that somehow that retirement is a period of depression, decline, disassociation, and that work really is what gives lots of people meaning and identity, and the lack of work, the retirement from work, is particularly debilitating. And I was surprised that the opposite is true, that what I found in my data is that the health of men and women actually improved when they retired. And time use studies that look at how the way people use their times, reveal the reason why health might improve when you retire. And that's because when people retire, they tend to do things that they enjoy doing the most. Now, for some people, work is an enjoyable activity. But for all of us, spending time with family and friends, doing a hobby, sleeping, preparing meals, eating meals, and I don't mean gourmet meals. I mean spending more time eating them, exercising a little bit, and having the absence of stress or a boss, being a low level of a hierarchy, actually improves physical and mental well-being. So that just told me right off the top that retirement was worth having, you know, that the ability to choose whether to work or not, which is really what retirement's about, you know, you can work or not work because you have enough money, is really valuable. Also, when you add in the psychological tasks that we have before we die, which is to create a meaning about what our life meant, is very important for people's psychological health. And so then I probed even further. Does the type of pension you have contribute to your well-being? And we're finding lots of data now that shows that people want steady income for the rest of their life, even if it's a modest amount. That the certainty of the income, the lack of worry about it going away is what people want, and they don't want the chance that they'll strike it rich with a good 401k investment.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, that in the beginning of the book, When I'm 64, you note that when you told people you were working on this book, they were put off by the phrase retirement leisure. And I know. I was surprised by that, and you were too.
Oh, yeah. It was embarrassing. I mean, people got really angry, especially kind of smartly dressed, healthy 70-year-old senators and people who had, and professionals that had really interesting jobs. They were really put off by both of the words, leisure and retirement, because to them, you know, work and industry, it always served them well, and they got highly rewarded for it, and they were well respected. And the only people that kind of got it, you know, that I wasn't talking about throwing them away or having them be lazy, were workers who had been working for a long time, and they had just kind of built up a dream about what they would do if they had free time.
Yeah.
And I was really affected by that, you know, by that modest expectation, you know, that we were able to give to everybody, regardless of social class. You know, that kind of ability to know that at the end of your life you'd have some time to take stock or do what you wanted to do.
Yeah. I don't want to go with my boots on. I want to go with my dancing shoes.
Yeah. No, that's a really good metaphor. You know, or your slippers, even if you're not going to do something exuberant, you know, or helpful, but just the idea to do what's meaningful to you. It's something that we had accepted in our society, and I'm stunned that there are people out there who think that a solution for our aging economy is just to make older people work.
Work longer.
Yeah. Or work longer kind of implies a more genial activity, which is, you know, you stay in your job where you're pretty well secure and you can just work a few more years. For most people, it means that you get laid off or you have to retire from your career job, and then you get laid off from retirement because you don't have enough money, and then you go take the jobs that basically we see teenagers take, you know, fast food and service.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit more about what's good about pensions and why we should have them and why we should. One of the things that you see that you would advocate for is something you call a guaranteed retirement account, and that's a combination of things. It's the government, it's what we can save, it's employer benefit plans. You write at one point in the book, pensions are part of the production system. They enhance productivity.
Mm-hmm.
So, if that's the case,
why don't we see more?
Yeah.
Right. We are seeing pensions being paid for and preserved by companies that realize that the numbers of younger people, you know, are lower than they are used to when the baby boomers were young, and that they really have to hang on to their middle-aged workers, 40s and their 50s. That those are really valuable employees. And those employees really care about pensions, so that they're finding that they need to make sure that those 40 and 50-year-olds are loyal, that they give 120%, and that they stay on the job. Well, the only way you're going to get people to give 110 or 120% is if you're going to reward them for it later on. And that's a pension. And if you can't make a credible claim that you as an employer will promise that pension, then you're going to find people giving, you know, 100% or less. And so that's the intuition behind why pensions actually add to productivity. It makes people, you know, work harder. The other good thing about pensions is that they are, and this might be complicated, but I think people will get it, they are a convenient way for us to have us workers to have a way to save money for our own retirement. The pensions are in some way kind of a bank, you know, a place where we can defer our wages and make sure that they're there for the rest of our lives. Now, defined benefit plans, the deferral isn't quite direct. You don't have an amount of money taken out of your check and put into the pension plan. But But, you know, your wages aren't as high as they would be if you didn't have any. And so it's a way we can take personal responsibility for our own income. The problem with saving it in a defined benefit plan as opposed to a 401k, or the difference is that the 401k is an inefficient way to save our money. It's very, very expensive. The fees are hidden, and they're so large that they can actually take away 20 to 30% of your total accumulation over your lifetime, and you don't see that. So pensions are good because they're a really convenient way for us to save for our own retirement.
Hmm. How are 403B plans?
Yeah, 403B plans are a little bit better because 403B plans, for your listeners, are 401K type plans for not-for-profit and government employees. And there, the employer is more responsible and keeps the fees lower. And they have restrictions about how many loans you can take out, and they have a better choice of vehicles. But they're really just marginally better because they're mostly not-for-profit, and the fees aren't these kind of retail fees, and you don't pay a lot for advertisement. But they're not much better than 401k.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, our guest this afternoon is economist Teresa Ghilarducci. She holds the Irene and Bernard L. Schwartz Chair of Economic Policy Analysis at the New School for Social Research. Her latest book is When I'm 64, The Plot Against Pensions and the Plan to Save Them. You can join our discussion this afternoon with a phone call. We invite your questions and comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, tell us about your rescue plan, the guaranteed retirement account.
Okay. I wanted to have your listeners have an image in their mind, which is of a pyramid, like a food pyramid. And on the base of that pyramid is Social Security and Medicare. The middle tier, you know, where you might put your meat and beans and protein, are your employer plans. You know, and above that are your own personal savings. It could be your stamp collection you're going to sell, your CD accounts, or your home equity. So most of us really build our retirement income on a pyramid, not a three-legged stool. You know, because the stool of personal savings, of employer pensions, Social Security isn't really. Those legs aren't equal for most of us. It's mostly Social Security, then employer pensions, and then personal savings. Well, so that's the pyramid that all of our policies have been built on, and that pyramid is being shaken up. We're now seeing the employer part of that being less important, and probably employers aren't going to go back into the pension business. Some will because it is productive, but it looks as though even if we do have that base, we really need more of that personal savings. So my plan is basically to put on top of Social Security a individual account that has a lot of the problems with 401ks corrected. So what will happen for all of us who aren't in DB plans, we will have to save 50% of our income into an account that is managed by the government in an agency that's similar to the agency that manages the accounts of all federal workers, members of Congress, the president, and all federal workers. You know, so we'll have most Americans piggyback on that federal pension system. That means that the return will be guaranteed. There will be no fluctuation of your 401k, you know, with the stock market. The government will guarantee a rate of return. The fees will be minuscule. They'll be, as small as they are for Federal Reserve workers and federal employees. You know, less than 1%, which is much lower than current 401k participants pay. And the lower income workers, well, everybody will get a $600 rebate from the government for that 5% contribution. And for low-income workers, that will cover almost all of their contributions, which means that my plan won't make life more miserable for low-income workers, you know, than it already is. It won't take away from their income. It'll come in the form of a tax credit. So they'll pay up front, but then they'll get it back with a tax system. So what it does is resurrect some plans that were talked about in the 1970s under the Carter administration, called the mandatory universal pension system, and it also mimics reforms that are happening in most of Europe. And what I like about it is that Republicans and Democrats both like it, because for the Republicans, it really pushes the idea that we're all responsible in part to save for our own retirement. But it's also recognizing that the government can help us have an efficient, low-cost vehicle with which to do it. So that's my plan. It's in, of course, in more detail in the book.
Yeah. Well, let's take some more calls. Next, we're going to take a call from a listener in Champaign. Line one, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Excellent program this afternoon, Celeste, and a very articulate speaker. I would like her comment on the idea of the Congress coming up with ideas for other good social programs in which people can borrow money from their 401ks, like the first-time home buyers for a down payment for your first home, or sending a child to college, and allowing people to tap into their 401k for these purposes.
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked that. Congress does allow employers who sponsor 401k plans to allow their workers to tap into their 401k accounts for these important purposes. Everybody needs to have a slush fund. Everybody needs to have savings accounts, because things that the caller just listed always comes up. The problem, however, is that if people tap into their 401k for those good purposes, they're going to lose out in retirement income. 401k plans, I call them good savings plans, you know, because any savings plan is good, but they're not retirement plans. So if I've told Congress before, and I've also talked about it in my book, that if you want to make 401k plans real retirement plans, you're going to have to ban all loans from 401k plans, ban all pre-retirement withdrawals, and mandate continual contributions. And then when you do that, you actually change the nature of 401ks, and they turn into a guaranteed retirement account.
That was fine. Did anybody in the Congress listen to you?
Yeah. You know, I was just there last week, and I met with lots of people who, for some reason, you know, these are actually, you know, people who work for the senators and congressmen. For some reason, retirement has come on the radar, and I think I know why. Because the swing states, the states where the Democrats and Republicans have to win in order to, you know, make it to the White House and to bring their party along in Congress, are actually states where there's a lot of workers who are older and they're losing their pensions. So all of a sudden, the fragility of the 401k system and the farce of it as a 401 as a pension system is coming to the forefront. So I'm really hopeful. But if you asked me last month, I wouldn't have been so.
Very good. Well, keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Next, we take a call from a listener in Fusland, line two. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
I was just wondering, how do you find out the fees at 401k, 403b plans? I'm 60, and I've got a couple of those.
Yeah, I am so sorry to say that it's almost impossible to find out what the fees are. The Washington Post ran an article a couple of weeks ago, I think it was about 3 weeks ago, where the financial journalist wanted to help out people just like you find out where their fees what their fees were. And it was a 10-step process, and there was also at the end of that process a recognition that you still might not be able to know the fees and that you would then ask your employer again. So all I can say to you right now is to go online And you can look for that Washington Post article, or you can type into Google how to discover 401k fees. And you can see for yourself what that 10-step process is. The other thing you can do is go to your employer and cross your or the employer that sponsored it and ask them to tell you what the fees are. You probably won't get an answer. So here's my best advice. Look at your 401k portfolios today when you get off this phone call and look at the names of the vehicles that you're in. And if any of those names don't have the word index or passive passive in that name, then sell them and go to the passive stock fund or your passive or index bond fund, because those are the vehicles that have much, much lower fees.
So avoid the indexes?
No, don't avoid. Go only in index. Avoid all what's called the actively managed funds. And they're the ones that will have all the fancy names. Small cap, international, some proper noun, high-flying equity fund. I mean, there's going to be a fancy name. And
the
you want to go to the plain vanilla investments.
Okay. And then is there any way I can transfer those?
Yeah.
That equity?
Yes. Every 401k plan has a way for you to transfer your income from one account to another. You will need to be cautious that you don't have all of your money in equities, especially if you're 60. You need someone looking over your shoulder. And don't do anything fancy. Go to the plain vanilla and distribute your income with bonds and stocks and a little bit of cash.
Okay, but
transfer
out of the 401k or 403b?
You probably are just as well keeping it there. But you should start asking questions that make the sponsor uncomfortable. Right. And then you'll get a lot of information there.
Okay. Yeah, I can do that. I think it's, outrageous that the fees are...
Yeah. No, it's outrageous. I mean, there was legislation that just got frozen in Congress to just merely expose what the fees are.
That's shameful.
Oh, it is shameful. And the reason is because of the political pressure from the financial industry.
Yeah.
That is the answer.
Yeah. Let's take another call. A listener in Indiana, line 4, last call this afternoon. Hi.
Hello.
Hello there. Go ahead.
Yes. I just wanted to make a couple comments to the guest on your show. I recently retired in the last 3 months, spent many years in a corporate position, and I am drawing a defined benefit plan as well as have 401k plans. And I would suggest that the main reason that employers are getting away from defined benefit plans is because they are too costly.
Yeah.
And some of the largest defined benefit plans within the country have gone under or had to been taken over by the government through their Retirement Income Security Act. And so they aren't necessarily 100% foolproof. And, in fact, the Teamsters Union, which is one of the largest defined benefit groups in the country, their plan is underfunded at this point. And there's a question as to whether they're going to continue to survive and be able to pay the same benefit that somebody might have retired hoping that they would receive $1,500 a month. Well, once it gets turned over to the government, it may not be $1,500 a month.
Yeah.
So retirement defined benefit plans aren't foolproof, and they are extremely costly, and it makes it difficult for employers to be competitive, and that is one of the reasons that so many jobs are going overseas is because of the cost of that item. So I would just suggest that nothing is free. There isn't a free lunch.
Mm-hmm. No, they're more costly because they're better for most workers. You're right. They're a single employer or industry has a hard time guaranteeing income for life. When they're fully funded, where some are, that guarantee is helpful. So there are flaws with both models. But from the point of view of a worker, it's much better to be in a defined benefit plan than a 401k plan in general.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Teresa Ghilarducci, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
I'm very happy to.
Our guest, economist Teresa Ghilarducci, is the author most recently of When I'm 64, The Plot Against Pensions and the Plan to Save Them, the publisher, Princeton University Press.